You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and on this podcast, you will find tons of relevant information that will help you become more successful in the field. You'll hear product information directly from the manufacturer and success stories from guys and gals just like you. Sit back, relax, and pour a stiff drink. This episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast starts right now. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras. I tell you what, it is absolutely crazy weather out there. I mean, we go from above freezing to below freezing. A lot of the snow melted. Now it's refrozen. And I've been driving around the part of the state that I live and hunt in over this weekend. And man, there is a lot of water and there is a lot of snow. And once we actually start getting a really good thaw, and this part of the state is going to see a lot of high water, we're going to see a lot of farmers struggling to get crops in this spring. And there are even a handful of farmers just in the route I take to get to the property that I hunt who still have crops in the field from this past fall, simply because the weather has been shitty, right? There was a lot of rain this fall. A lot of guys couldn't get out. Then it froze, then it thawed, then it froze, a lot of snow, you know, this cycle. And man, I just really feel sorry for, I don't really feel sorry for them. They know what they're getting into and they deal with it every year. And every year you hear these stories about, the farmers are struggling to get their crops in the field, but they always do, right? They always make it happen. They always make it work. So kudos to those guys and the career that they've picked. But the deer, right? I was down in the part of the area where I hunt, and all this rain that we recently had melted a majority of the snow. So today, when I was driving home through this area, I was like, oh, I was really itching to get out and start looking for sheds. But I had it was my daughter's birthday weekend this weekend. She turned 6, and I'm telling you right now, I cannot believe how fast the last 6 years of my life has been, and how fast my family has grown, and how fast life is happening. And man, I always say you gotta slow down and enjoy it, and it's not happening. Like, you can't slow down life. I was talking with my father-in-law, who is 69 years old. He's getting ready to turn 70 in October. And he told me, I blink and I thought I was 45 again. And here I am 70. So that's how fast life goes by. And my kids are growing so fast. And all these crazy things in my life are happening. And you blink and you're having your daughter's 6th birthday. I can literally remember the moment they pulled my daughter out of my wife and set her on this, you know, set her on my wife's chest. And my daughter's, she didn't cry. I thought something was wrong. She didn't cry for like the first 24 hours of her life. Just calm, eyes wide open all the time, looking around. She would sleep, she would nurse, then she would go back. But she never cried, not one time in like the first 24 hours. And I can remember her, you know, laying on my wife's chest. And she was looking at me. I know for a fact that we made eye contact, right? And I look at my daughter. She's looking back at me. and she smiles, right? Now, they say that a baby can't smile. She doesn't know how to smile. Her muscles don't know how to smile, like all the emotion and stuff. But if I was a betting man, I would say that was a smile. And from that moment on, you know, my life changed and the game was over. Like, at that moment, I knew that part of my life was I was meant to be a father, and specifically to that girl. And, you know, since then, I have two more kids, and it is a blessing every single day. And I bitch a lot about it on my podcast. I bitch about it on the Wired to Hunt podcast, more as a joke. But it's like, parenting is really difficult. And I sit there and I joke about, you know, like, well, there's feces on the floor, or they color on the wall, or they hit each other, or they fight, and or there's no sleep. But I was reminded this weekend that every second of that is worth it because of how fast life is going. And I feel myself getting frustrated with my kids sometimes, and I have to realize that that's the small stuff, right? You have to enjoy every single moment. And hopefully the parents out there, or the people thinking about having kids someday, get to experience the feels, the quote unquote feels that I have for my children and my wife and my family. Because I am, you know, people say they're blessed a lot, and I don't know what that means really. But what I do know is that I am happy with my life in that range. Like, I am so happy that I have a healthy family. I have a healthy children, healthy parents, healthy in-laws and family. And I know I'm going off on a crazy tangent on this, but it's very important for me to say these things, because in the grand scheme of things, your family trumps everything in life. It trumps your job. It trumps this passion of deer hunting, right? Because make no mistake about it, if it comes down to deer hunting or my family, I'm going to choose my family every single time, right? If there was this crazy ultimatum that had to be made, and I had to choose between bow hunting or hunting and fishing in the outdoors, but I got to keep my family and all this stuff, if there was this crazy ultimatum that, you know, these hypothetical situations, I choose my family every single time. I'm just lucky that my family enjoys the same passion that I do, right? Not to the extent that I do, but I don't know. It's just a lot of things in my life are, in life in general, are crazy. It can change in the drop of a hat, the snap of fingers, a blink of an eye. Life changes. And I just want to be, I don't want to regret anything at the end. I've regretted too much of my life already. I want to change that. I want to move forward in a positive, a very positive light, and bring my family with me and just enjoy everything about life to the fullest every single day. I sorry for the tangent. But we do have a really good podcast today, right? We're going to be joined by Danny Ard, and he's going to talk. This is a BS session, right? It's a good old-fashioned bullshit session, and we are going to talk about his kind of journey as a hunter, right? He hunts the Appalachians. He talks about like crazy hike-ins, like miles and miles hiking in to try to find good sign. He talks about his transition from kind of being your average Joe tree stand hunter to being more of a mobile run and gun type hunter. He talks about a trip to Africa. We talk about his service in the military. We just kind of talk a little bit about everything, which makes for a really good BS session. And speaking of mobile hunting, today we're going to talk a little bit about lone wolf. You guys know that I am an avid lone wolf user, right? LoneWolfHuntingProducts.com. That's the website. So if you want to find out more information about why I love Lone Wolf tree stands, Lone Wolf portable tree stands, LoneWolfHuntingProducts.com is the website you need to go check out. I'm a huge fan of the Assault. It is 100% of the reason being mobile and having a great tree stand to be mobile with is 100% of the reason why I killed the buck that I killed this year. So I think everybody needs to go check it out. And if you do decide to purchase from lonewolfhuntingproducts.com, enter the discount code 9FC50 and you will save $50 off of all orders over $200. So that's a really good discount there. So this has been a very long intro. I do apologize. So enough of the chit chat. Let's just get into today's BS Session podcast with Danny Ard. All right, on the phone with me right now, Mr. Danny Ard. How you doing, man?
Good, Dan. How are you?
Can't complain. Too much snow. I'm done with it.
Yeah, we just got hit today, actually. Not as much as you guys are getting out there, but it's still too much.
Yeah. Despite what people say, it is hard to shed hunt in like 10 inches of snow on the ground.
I agree. Yeah, like I was saying before, man, I had to get my dog out there yesterday and try to find a couple before we got hit with a storm. So luckily found a couple sheds, but awesome. Definitely wasn't what I expected.
Yeah. So why don't you tell everybody where you're from and what do you do for a living?
I'm from Northern Virginia. I was actually raised in Alaska, but when I got out of high school, I joined the Army and did about 8 years in the Army. Had one deployment to Iraq, and then after that, I decided to get out and ended up joining the fire department. So I've been a paramedic firefighter now for about 13 years. And okay. Other than that, been bow hunting for about 10 years.
Nice. So question, yeah. Do you have any crazy stories either with the military or with being a paramedic or firefighter that you can share with us? Because I always like hearing some of these crazy stories.
Yeah, I do. I can't think of anything right off the top of my head that's appropriate for all viewers.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So. I had a buddy who he was a paramedic. He did some kind of internship. I want to say it was Kansas City. That doesn't sound right, but it was a bigger city. And I'm just like, hey man, you got any crazy horse, like crazy stories you can share with me? And he's just like, people come in shot and stabbed all the time. And it's so common that it's not even a crazy story anymore.
Right. Yeah. I guess I can relate to some of that. Our biggest thing right now is the heroin epidemic. So any overdose where somebody quits breathing on us, that's really just kind of almost a routine call for us now.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So you went to, did you say Iraq for a deployment?
Yeah. My last year in the military, I did one combat tour in Iraq.
Nice. So my buddy went to Iraq. I don't even know what, were you in the Army or National Guard or what were you in?
I was active duty Army.
Active duty Army. Okay, gotcha.
Yes.
So what was it like over there?
I think I couldn't really compare it to anything, but it was, if I was going to describe Baghdad, Iraq, which is where I was, it was definitely very dirty. It was kind of like the Wild West in a certain way because, you know, police didn't really have things in check, I guess, for lack of better terms. You know, it was definitely dangerous. It wasn't like, I remember back then when I was in and serving, I remember when I saw the news when I came home and the news kind of made it look like it was Vietnam and there was, you know, if you were going to leave the camp itself or the FOB is what we called it, that you're guaranteed to get shot at. And it wasn't always like that. I mean, we definitely had our skirmishes and whatnot that we got into, but it wasn't as bad as what I thought the press made it out to be.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, whenever you hear, you know, hear about the war on, or you see pictures of it, they always share like the worst possible picture of like all these dilapidated buildings with like gun holes in them. And they've been blown up and bombs gone off. And is that, I mean, I'm sure there's parts of that, of the town of Baghdad that are like that, but it can't be all the whole city, right?
from what I remember, every part of the city that I saw was pretty, you know, beat up and dirty and whatnot. There were some other areas that were better well kept, I guess, especially where Saddam's palace was and those type of areas. But I didn't really venture through those very much, I guess, because I was needed more where, you know, things were a little nastier.
Yeah, absolutely. How old were you when you were in when you were on deployment?
I was 26 years old, I believe.
Okay.
26.
How old are you now?
I'm 41.
41. Okay, so it's been a handful of years, huh?
Yeah, it has. Yep.
So, how old were you then when you started getting into hunting?
It's been about 10 years now, so I was about early 30s, 31 years old, okay. Maybe 32 at the oldest. Yeah.
So compared to most people, you kind of were a little late to the game. What was the reason that made you say, hey, I want to be a hunter?
I think it just looked really interesting to me. And I had hunted a little bit when I was a kid. Mostly small game stuff. I went big game hunting with my dad a few times. But I was at that age, I was more concerned with, you know, typical teenager stuff, I guess, hanging out with my friends and, you know, chasing girls or whatnot, not going to the gun range like I should have with my dad if we're getting ready for a caribou hunt. And, you know, I never was successful, but I had a good time fishing with my buddies and my, you know, dad and brother.
Gotcha.
But when I got into hunting about 10 years ago, I had actually been living in Baltimore City as a young firefighter, and I was kind of, you know, hitting the bar scene a lot, and I just kind of decided this, you know, this whole city life was just not for me. I was going to, you know, end up ruining my liver and my paycheck if I stayed in the city. So I ended up running away from the city, and I rented this farmhouse out in the country. I think it sat on about 100 acres, and I had a roommate at the time who was into the bow hunting scene. So I just kind of decided to pick his brain, and I told him, hey, I'm interested in hunting deer. I just don't really know what I'm doing, and I don't really see myself grabbing a bolt action rifle, and, you know, I wanted to be kind of challenging. I thought about using a muzzle loader, and I bought a cheap muzzle loader from Bass Pro, didn't know what I was doing, and I kept screwing it up with, I think the black powder got too much moisture in at one time, and then another time I think I overloaded the black powder, another time I underloaded it, and it just wasn't working out for me. So he said, well, hey, I got this old hand-me-down Hoyt bow. He said, if you want to, you know, you can put a little bit of money into it, take it to a bow shop, get it set up to your draw length, and get some arrows and whatnot for it. And that's what I ended up doing. He kind of showed me what to do, helped me hang a tree stand up there on that farm. And I went out there, and I think on my second or third sit, I had a spike and a doe come walking by, and they actually walked right underneath my tree. I went ahead and drew back on this doe at 15 yards right after I stopped her, and hit her right behind the shoulder, and she ran off. And I think that was probably the biggest surge of adrenaline that I've ever had, more so with my job in the fire department and more so than what I had when I was deployed to Iraq in the military.
Wow.
And that right there just, that had me hooked right then and there.
Wow.
Yeah. Ever since then, man, you can't keep me out of the woods.
That's awesome. That's a pretty good first experience. Now, you know, a lot of people decide to start with a gun and then transition, you know, to archery. Why did you decide, you know, I want to do archery first?
I think mostly because I'm not against hunting with firearms. In fact, I've picked up a rifle before and hunted with a firearm and still had a really good time with it. But I wanted something a little more challenging, or something that at least seemed more challenging. And bow and arrow just looked like, you know, the way to go for me.
Right. So when you picked up that bow for the first time and started shooting it, you know, you took it to the bow shop. How long did it take you to get comfortable to the point where you're like, you know what, I feel like I can go and try to kill a deer now?
I want to say probably about, I think I shot for about maybe 2 or 3 months. With my work schedule, though, being off for 3 days in a row, you know, I could shoot every single day and almost all day if I didn't have anything else going on. So I was ready to at least comfortably shoot something at 20 yards after about 3 months anyway.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So then at that point, you became comfortable. You went out, you killed a deer. Was that on your first time out you ever bow hunting?
I think it was actually my second or third. Okay. I think the first time that I went out there, I had some does that came running by right at last light. And I wasn't ready at all whatsoever. I was sitting there messing with my phone. And when they came trotting by, I was like, well, do I, try to stop them or do I just fling an arrow at them? I don't know what to do. So I just let them go.
Yeah.
I was too worried. I was going to screw it up and either wound one or miss one or, anything of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, your quote unquote first time out, whether that was the first time or, second or third time out, you got successful. Once you actually killed the deer, did that open your eyes to, hey man, I want to do this all the time? Or did it not get as serious right off the bat?
I think right off the bat, I think it was almost like my ears pinned back a little bit. My teeth got a little sharper and I just wanted more.
Yeah.
I was excited to go out there the very next day if I could and do it all again. But I think I celebrated a little bit too hard that first night with that first deer that I got. So I wasn't getting anything done the next day. But
oh, that's
but
funny.
Yeah, man, after that, every chance that I had, I was out there in the woods in a tree stand. And I didn't even care if there was a tornado warning out there. I wanted to be out there, even though everybody else would tell me, no, you're not going to see any deer. You just couldn't keep me out of the woods.
Okay. Yeah. Let's see here. So after, that first year finding success in the timber, what were like the next, what was the next 5 years like? I mean, did you continue to go out and do the same thing, or did you try to educate yourself more on not necessarily going out and killing a doe, but trying to kill bucks, trying to kill big mature bucks, trying to locate deer beds? Did you do any type of, training?
I did, but it wasn't really to the extent that I did over the last couple of years. I want to say probably about 5 or 6 years after that first deer that I took, I was watching the Hunting Channel all the time. And, I thought that was what, big buck hunting was. I wasn't really noticing that these guys that are on the hunting channels are more than likely hunting, a large ranch where the deer are kind of controlled with their numbers. And it was a lot different than the public land hunting. So I had a lot of sits out there where I was lucky if I saw does. I had killed some bucks over that next few years. They just weren't anything. They weren't giants or anything.
Yeah.
And with that being said, I'm still in the process right now of I want to take that, that large caliber whitetail, like the deer of the lifetime kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, and lately over the last couple of years, I've kind of gotten more into listening to more podcasts, reading more books about it, scouting a lot harder, trying to find out where the bucks bed, try to find out where they travel based on what time of year and what the acorns are doing, et cetera.
Right. Okay. So what would you say in the last, specifically bow hunting, or maybe there's a takeaway of hunting in general, what has been one of the biggest, whether it was an aha moment or maybe it was a whole bunch of little moments that have been refined to, be a good lesson for you, so to speak?
I think most of it was any time that I actually saw deer or had success on deer, I guess you could call those kind of aha moments, because I kind of thought to myself, wow, this really worked. And a lot of that, I think, was based on finding out where they bed. But the main thing is when I learned how to find fresh sign and get set up on fresh sign with the wind in my favor, that was the big aha moment. When I discovered that, that was kind of a game changer. In fact, I'd say it was a huge game changer for me.
So you located, you educated yourself to look for sign and set up on that sign or downwind of that sign. And was that something that instantly started working for you? Like you saw way more deer once you started doing that?
I would say yes. My numbers of, you know, the amount of deer that I saw while out there in the tree, it did increase once I learned how to set up on sign and play the wind.
Yeah. Okay. How many times would you say throughout that whole time period where you're teaching yourself to play the wind, would you say you failed and got busted?
To tell you the truth, I can't even count how many times I failed and got busted.
So
even though you're out there playing the wind, you can't predict what the wind's going to do. We just don't have any control over it, you know? So there were times where I would look at the weather channel and look at the app on my phone and say, okay, the wind's doing this. And I get out there, you know, I'm, you know, checking the wind on my way in and I get all set up and everything. And, you know, an hour later, the wind does a complete 180 on me and either I don't see anything or that group of does is walking right by the stand, you know, they end up winding me and huffing and puffing and running off and that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you say you started, you know, once you started setting up on sign and playing the wind, you know, that's a really good combination and you started seeing more deer. Did you also start getting more deer into shooting range because of that?
I would say, yes, I did. Mostly does and younger bucks. But yeah, I did start seeing a lot more deer once I started taking those two factors and, you know, playing those on the playing cards. It definitely paid for itself as far as seeing more deer.
Gotcha. So yeah. You've mentioned that you go and set up on fresh sign and you also hunt some public ground, which leads me to believe that you're trying to be a mobile hunter.
Very much indeed, yes. The mobile hunting thing is primarily what I do.
Gotcha.
I also hunt an urban area in Northern Virginia where we're allowed to set up our tree stands for the season. So I also do on public land as well. I do a lot of scouting in the off season, just like I think a lot of us do. As soon as the season's over with, we're out there looking for sheds, looking for sign, you know, where are the scrapes, where are the buck beds, etc. And setting up a tree stand based off of that stuff, I don't think it's always guaranteed. I had some sits in the past where that's the hand that I played on my hunting cards. And I went out there and set up over that, you know, what I thought was really awesome based off of what I found back in the postseason. And I was lucky if I saw a crow fly over my head. It was, you know, it was a ghost town.
Yeah. Yeah, those days happen, man.
Yeah.
So when it comes to, you know, now you mentioned the mobility factor. Did you start off, because on the email you sent to me, you mentioned you've started using a saddle. But did you start off with a climber or did you start off with like a hang on and sticks? What was your initial mobile setup?
My initial mobile setup was a hang on. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was a climber. And it was, I think, X-Op. Is it X-Op? No. X-Stand. X-Stand made it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was all kinds of excited because I found one as light as 12 pounds. But I had a lot of issues with a climber. There were times where I found fresh sign and, you know, I couldn't set up over that fresh sign because either I couldn't get the cables all the way around the tree or there are too many branches in the way. And I was lucky if I could get up to 8 feet. So, but I killed some deer out of that climber. It just wasn't as mobile as I wanted it to be because I still had to basically, it's almost like I was hunting the trees and not hunting the sign anymore.
Right. Yeah. And that's a big problem, in my opinion, with climbing tree stands. Now, in the South, I talk to these guys where, you know, they hunt these pine thickets and the trees are all straight and they're all, you know, you can climb up 10, 15, 20 feet in them and not encounter another branch. Where I hunt in Iowa, if I have to have stand and sticks in order to get into some of these trees, unless I'm going to be cutting, you know, a 6-inch limb off an oak tree or something like that, which isn't going to happen.
Yeah, same here.
So then you decided to move to a saddle, and this is a buzzword or it's starting to gain in popularity right now.
I noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. So my question to you is, why did you decide to go from a climber to a saddle?
The main reason was based off of YouTube videos, I think, you know, maybe a book or two that I read and some research online on, especially on saddlehunter.com. With that mobile setup, with that tree saddle, the number one factor for me is the terrain that I hunt here in Northern Virginia and West Virginia is basically considered mountainous terrain. I'm hunting elevations of, I think my highest is about 3,600 feet.
Okay.
So weight means everything to me, even if it's a pound. If I can shed a pound here and there, I definitely will if I'm not going to need it. So that saddle wrapped around my waist, I think it only weighs about 2 pounds versus a heavy tree stand or whatever. So that was the weight was the main factor, as well as the mobility, as being able to get up into any tree that I want to. That was another factor. Another big plus too is when I'm up there in that tree and the terrain that I hunt, it doesn't matter if I could get to the very top of a 80-foot tree, and it's not going to matter if those deer are coming down the hill towards me, because they're, you know, I'm at eye level with them. So it's what I can do in that saddle is I can set myself up and move around that tree if I have to actually hide myself from the deer. And then if they happen to surprise me and pop out on a side that I don't expect, I can actually maneuver all the way around that tree to make a shot.
Gotcha.
So
how long did it take you to learn how to use a saddle?
It didn't take me very long, I don't think. There was a learning curve, but I think, you know, I just had to practice it a little bit. And I would go out there this last summer. I think I bought my first saddle in the spring, or maybe early summer, and I felt comfortable in it by the time hunting season came around. So I'd say after about a month of practicing climbing up and shooting from it, after about a month, maybe 2 months at the most, I felt pretty comfortable in it and to shoot from it.
Have you had any scenarios where the saddle, or any positions that you were in where you were in a saddle and you weren't able to make the shot because the deer came in from a specific angle or direction?
No, certainly not.
Okay.
After some research online and YouTube videos and some help from some other guys on saddlehunter.com, which is, I'm sure you might have heard of it, it's a website for their saddle hunting forum. I learned all kinds of different tricks from those guys on how to get yourself around the other side of the tree and still take a nice steady shot. And it worked out pretty good, I thought.
Gotcha. Yeah. You know, I find that intriguing. But every time I think about, hey, giving a saddle a try, I keep going back to the deer that I shot this year. And I don't think that I would have been able to do what I did in a tree stand in a saddle. From the time that this buck showed up to the time that I shot it was somewhere around 30 or 40 seconds, right? So it was under, he came in from behind me. On my non-draw side, or on my draw side. So that means I would have had to turn my body all the way, and I was facing the tree, right? So I had to turn my body all the way around, and at 4 yards, 4 or 5 yards, I'm almost positive he would have heard me or saw me in the tree. And then when I did finally get to a point where I could draw back, he was behind some branches. So I had to change levels and drop down in my tree stand, like kind of squat in my tree stand. And I don't know if I could have done, if I could have pulled that shot off with, while in a saddle, which that scenario alone makes me hesitant to even try one. And I'm not sitting here trying to bash the saddle. I'm just saying that specific example, I'm not sure if I could have pulled that off or not.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'm not pro saddle and I'm not anti tree stand. You know, I think everybody has their own preference on what they want to use, what works better for this and that and each individual hunter. But you know, based on what you're telling me, it, you know, I'd have to be in your shoes at that time to say, you know, I could make it happen or not make it happen, you know? So I think there's been times where I was in a tree stand and I couldn't get a shot because of this situation or that situation. If I was on a tree saddle, maybe it would have been better. But then again, vice versa. This is only my first season hunting out of a tree saddle. So, I'm still learning, you know, what all I can and can't do with it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's one of those things where to each their own. And I know some guys who absolutely love them. They absolutely love them. And, you know, like you said, going up huge inclines to get to some of your tree stand or, you know, some of your trees, your hunting locations, you know, weight does matter. For me in Iowa, like if I ever start bitching about having to hike in a half a mile or even let's say the longest I may have to walk to one of the, on the farms that I hunt is maybe 3/4 of a mile. If I ever start bitching about having to walk on fairly flat ground with, you know, a lone wolf and four sticks on my back and complain that it's too heavy, well, I'm getting old at that point.
I can definitely understand. Most of the places that I go to, because it's public land, is I'm looking at sometimes a 6-hour hike to get to them.
A six?
Through the mountains.
Six hours?
Yeah, at the most. On average, it's about 2 to 4 hours for most of these spots.
Wait a second. You hike in 2 to 4 hours every single time?
Correct. I do, yes.
Holy shit. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, you know, that's where that weight really matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I was talking with a guy. Man, this was maybe late January, or it was, I think we did the podcast in January where he was doing like a 3,500 or a 25. I know this is a big difference, but either 25 or 3,500 descent from the road down into this, you know, where the deer were at, and then having to hike back up it every night.
That's pretty rugged, pretty tough.
So I'm thinking that's the same kind of Appalachian hill country you're probably hunting in. Like that.
It is. Yeah. Pretty unforgiving terrain.
So are the deer, are there deer all over, or like you just decide to go back that deep and that far because there's less hunters and quite frankly, you can do it.
Yeah. And not only that, but of course, it keeps me in shape at my old age. but the main reason is I'm trying to get to where the deer are. I think most of your average hunters around where I am anyway on the public land, they park their truck and they, you know, hop out and they walk maybe, 200 or 300 yards and get set up and they sit there and they're lucky if they see a doe or two. Maybe a spike. They shoot the first thing they see, and then, you know, that's their public land hunting strategy right there. Which I don't see anything wrong with that. They can do that all they want. And tell you the truth, the more that they stay closer to the road, that means the more success I might have out there further out.
No shit, you're hiking 6 hours. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's my farthest scenario is 6 hours.
Right. So how far from? I know there's probably some ups and some downs and some elevation gains and descents in these hikes. But how far? How many miles away from your truck does 2 to 4 hours get you?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I think I tried to measure it out one time with this GPS app that I use on my phone, and I think it came out to a couple miles.
Yeah. Man, that must be some rugged terrain.
What's that?
That must be some rugged terrain.
It is, yeah. And to tell you the truth, where I park, I normally start out on an old logging road. So sometimes I'm hiking for about maybe 2 to 2.5 hours on a logging road. And then when I get to the base of the hilltop or mountaintop that I want to get up onto, then it's about another, you know, 2.5, 3 hours or whatever to get up to the top.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that's crazy.
And a lot of that depends on, you know, what time it, like if I'm going out there for a morning hunt, you know, I'm out there at pitch black walking around with just a headlamp on, trying to maneuver my way through all the thick, nasty mountain laurels and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you going back that far because there's more deer back there and better quality of deer?
That's basically what my firm belief has been. This last year, it didn't really pay off the way that I wanted it to. So being that far out, I think like I was saying before, you know, you can go all the way out there thinking that all that scouting you did, you know, last postseason was going to pay off. When I went out there, you know, on a, like one of my hikes was actually about a 4 or 5 hour hike on this area that I thought was just going to be awesome.
Yeah.
You know, it had scrapes and rubs all over the place, and I found bedding, and I was like, okay, this is it. This is where I'm, you know, there's got to be something big in here. And I'm looking at the rub size and everything, and I went out there, and after a long hike through the pitch dark and fight my way through mountain laurel and whatnot, and I didn't see anything, but I think I saw one squirrel.
Yeah.
So, man, that's crazy. My strategy will probably change a little bit next season. I'm probably not going to be doing as many morning hunts through the pitch black unless something changes my mind and I find another reason to. But as what I'm going to do is I'm still going to scout postseason, but I'm going to do more afternoon hunts where I can see so that I can pick up on fresh sign. And if there's fresh sign in that area, I'll hunt it. If not, then I'll either keep hiking or not waste to sit out there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. All right. Yeah. So in this group of pictures that you sent me, you're holding a bear. Is that also from the area that you hunt?
It is. Yes. Yeah. It was public land bear taken in West Virginia.
Okay. So was that the same type of, when was that bear harvested?
That was not this last season, but the season before.
Okay. So was that just a spot in stock? October.
No, definitely was not a spot in stock. Because what I had done is that summer out hiking around, I wanted to take a black bear really bad with a bow. It was just the next thing on my bucket list.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, of course, reading more books about it and YouTube videos, just trying to gather all the information that I could. And I can't remember the name of the book or who the author was, but I read in his book about scouting tactics for black bears. And essentially, if you find an area that gets a lot of sun, there's not a lot of thick stuff in the way to cover up the ground, which I guess causes more rainfall to get in there and more sunlight, which is going to give that hillside more vegetation. And more vegetation, the more the bears like to go there and eat, you know, the natural vegetation growing there.
Yeah.
Then another thing to pick up on too that I found out in that book was look for these old rotted stumps or fallen trees. And you can tell when a black bear has gotten onto one of these rotted away stumps or fallen trees, because they go in there and they just rip it apart looking for termites to eat. So I just scouted around looking for that kind of stuff all summer. And I found that plus plenty of bear scat. And, you know, I ended up going into an area that I had pre-scouted and got up there in a climber. And I just happened to get lucky. I was set up just on the downwind side of where all this sign was. And at first I couldn't see them, but you can kind of tell. I don't know if you've ever been around many black bears where you're at. I don't know if you guys have them or not, but
no.
If at first you kind of wonder, like, okay, is that a deer? And you're like, no, it actually sounds like a person walking. And that's kind of what I thought, was that it was a person walking through the woods. So here I'm getting ready to, you know, kind of wave my arms and say, like, all right, here's this jerk that found out where I'm hunting. And sure enough, this black bear comes out at say 40 yards, but the bear kept moving and went behind some more brush and trees. So I, you know, got my bow in my arm and I said, all right, Danny, let's see how this plays out. And he stopped right there at I think it's 10 or 12 yards, and was kind of, the bear was facing to my left, but its vitals were behind a tree, probably about as, oh, I don't know, about as big around as a basketball, I guess. And when it stepped out, I went ahead and came to full draw and put my pin right behind its shoulder. And it took that front leg and had one step forward. And it was also kind of turned its head to the right, looking downhill and away from me. So I thought, all right, this is perfect. That bear just brought the shoulder blade out of the way, so I'm gonna let this broadhead fly right through its vitals. And I tell you what, right when I let that arrow fly, it snapped its head back to the left, pulled that shoulder blade back in the way, and I punched that arrow right into its shoulder blade. And I'm shooting those Luminox out of my bow, and this bear let off a snarl and looked back at, you know, almost like it looked back at my arrow wondering what it was that stung it. And just goes running off through the woods with my arrow sticking halfway out. And this is also an evening hunt. So it was my first bear that I've ever shot or anything. I didn't really have much experience with black bears. So I texted one of my buddies that has some experience up there in the mountain and told him what happened. And he said, don't go tracking that bear without your pistol on you. I had brought him back and I said, you know, I've always got my handy pistol with me just because there's, you know, bears and stuff out there. But
right.
And he said, if you really want to play it smart, he said, just back out right now. And he said, try to sleep on it tonight and go back in there after tomorrow morning. And that night, I think we've all been there if we've ever made a bad shot on any animal. I laid there playing the scenario through my head the entire night.
Yeah.
Wondering, you know, what if this happened? What if that happened? You know, what if I did just get one lung? What if I got both lungs? And, of course, I didn't sleep that whole night. And right at daybreak, I go out there and had my bow with me, had my pistol on my hip, and had my binoculars. And I went back to where I knew I had shot the bear and started tracking them real slow from there. Had an arrow knocked at first, but had to put the arrow back in the quiver because I had to actually crawl on all fours through a bunch of more nasty mountain laurel. Imagine that. And you know how when deer, when they run, they kind of take the path of least resistance most of the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, not bears. So I finally tracked this thing. I think I looked on my GPS later, and it was 340 yards. And every time I saw something that would look like it might be a bear, I bring in my binoculars and look at it. Of course, it always turned out to be either a dark rock or a really dark tree stump or something. And after maybe the, I don't know, fourth or fifth time, I raise up my binoculars and told myself, all right, let's see what this stupid dark rock looks like. And raise up my binoculars, and I thought, well, it's a pretty hairy looking rock. So knocked an arrow again and crept up a little closer, got within 20 yards of it. I could tell it's laying on its side, but I didn't want to take any chances. So I threw a rock at it, and bear didn't move. Just a bunch of dust came flying off of it. So I crept in a little closer and pulled the pistol out just in case if this thing were to rise up and, you know, try to take revenge on me or whatever. I just wasn't taking any chances. And the bear was as dead as can be. So
how far from your tree stand?
About 340 yards, I think.
Yeah.
So, my, very wonderful, loving wife came out there to help me field dress this bear, and you also have to you have to keep the proof of sex.
Right.
So they wanted DNR wanted me to pull out an ovary or something. And so my wife, she's not much of a hunter, and here she is holding the legs open to this bear while I'm digging through a pile of guts trying to find an ovary. And then we had to drag this thing out of the national forest, which took a lot more time than what I thought it would.
Wow.
And we also had to catch a flight that evening. And you know, my wife was not happy with me at all whatsoever. So I owed her a really nice expensive dinner after that one.
Yeah, I would. My wife has yet to help me do any type of deer dragging or anything like that. So
yeah.
There's going to come a time where I think she's going to have to, but,
right. Yeah.
But, just because I won't be able to call anybody else, she'll be the last person. I'm like, you get your butt out here and you gotta help me. So
yeah,
she won't be happy about it, but I'll buy her something from the dollar menu.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Or another thing that works too, is I just keep the wine flowing afterwards.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. So you shot a bear. You're starting to refine your deer hunting strategy. Let me ask you this, because you also sent me some pictures of you going to Africa.
Yes. Right?
So I'm the kind of guy right now in my life where I'm just like, man, I want to hunt so many North American game species that I don't want to go over to. I don't want to go anywhere else. You know, if there was some kind of crazy opportunity, yes, maybe. But okay. Me personally at this time, I don't have any interest in going to Africa.
Okay.
Am I wrong in saying that? Or because I've talked to people who have been like, dude, I thought the same thing. Then I went and it's a game changer.
It certainly was a game changer for me just because it was another hunting adventure. And if anything, it's a very memorable one for me because I got to hunt with my dad.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's definitely very active and everything for his age. And, it's not like he's circling a drain. He's, you know, in his mid-60s now. But this is kind of our last chance for him and I to go on a really cool, you know, somewhere else in the world hunting trip, you know, before, you know, he can't do it anymore or I can't afford it anymore or whatever, which I don't think I'll be able to afford it again. But
how much did that trip cost you?
Let's see. The hunting trip itself, where they think, I think it got me 7 different species. The hunt itself was
$3,500. Okay.
And that's 7 species. And that's what they call a plains game hunt. So you're not going after your, what do they call it? The dangerous eight or whatever.
Yeah.
But that includes, you know, your boarding and food and drinks and whatever else. But you also need to keep in mind if you're getting any of this stuff taken care of through a taxidermist, that's going to cost you. And also you got to tip your guide. So.
Gotcha.
And then, of course, your airfare.
Yeah. So overall, first question is, did you get any of those animals that you shot over there? Because I'm seeing a picture of what, a wildebeest and is that that's not a kudu. What's that?
No, it's called a gemsbuck.
Gemsbuck, yeah, gemsbuck.
Yeah.
So those are
the two that I was able to take with a bow and arrow.
Okay.
So essentially is what happened. It kind of starts out as a sad story, I guess, because flew on British Airways, and they lost my bow on the way over there.
Oh, shit.
And, yeah, this was my, you know, my Matthews bow. I had it all set up for taking African game, and I had practiced with it for a year, you know, with the perfect arrow weight and perfect broadheads and everything. And my heart sank when that bow did not make it there. So I ended up having to use borrowed archery tackle. My guide, who was outstanding guy, he was, you know, able to last minute borrow a bow from somebody, get it set up to my draw length, and you know, set up with arrows and everything, whole nine yards. Only issue was it didn't have a kisser button, which I'm used to shooting with a kisser button.
Yeah.
And I had shot, you know, we went out to some spot and stock on some animals. I shot at and missed, I think, a couple warthogs and ended up missing one gemsbuck and just wasn't really going my way. And then I was so upset because, well, not upset, but I was kind of down. I wasn't having as much fun as I could have been because every evening my dad and his long-term buddy from high school, they were out hunting with rifles and they had a story to tell every single evening around the campfire when we were having drinks after everybody hunted. And I was still empty-handed. And I texted my wife one evening after probably, I'd say about, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 days into hunting and being discouraged. I texted her just, you know, because she's my wife, I guess, telling her how upset I was about them missing my bow and whatnot. And she made a very valid point. She said, "We can replace your bow. That's not a problem." He said, "What you cannot replace is this time that you're spending with your dad." She said, "I know you're a diehard bow hunter and, you know, you don't want to hunt with anything else but a bow and arrow, but you need to swallow your pride, pick up a rifle, have fun with your dad, and that's it." She said, "Because you can't get that time back that you're spending right now in a different country on the other side of the world on a hunting trip with your dad." And I said, "Okay, all right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go out and hunt tomorrow with bow and arrow. If I don't get anything, I'm switching over to the gun." And that's exactly what I did. And that exact same day, I ended up putting a stock in with my guide. We put a stock in on that blue wildebeest. And on our way stalking towards that blue wildebeest, we came up on a pair of gemsbuck that were feeding and working their way towards us. And after crawling around on rocks and everything and getting within 50 yards of these gemsbuck, I drew back and made the shot. And I wasn't too sure of the shot. We just weren't really seeing a whole lot of blood. So we start tracking this gemsbuck. And we totally forgot about the blue wildebeest at this point. Tracking this gemsbuck. And as we're tracking it, we end up coming up on the hill where this blue wildebeest was. And I guess kind of like our rut over here with whitetails and other species, this blue wildebeest actually had his own hill with rubs all over the place. Instead of scrapes, though, he had piles of his own dung right there, which I guess that's how they leave their scent to warn all the other male blue wildebeest that that's his mating territory. And we start getting closer to this blue wildebeest while we're still tracking the gemsbuck. And he noticed that we were getting too close, and he started grunting at us and scraping his hoof into the ground. And my guide, he said, "Danny, he's at 52 yards. So I drew back on him, and he was completely broadside. I drew back on him, let the arrow fly, and he kind of jumped the string, I guess is what you call it, just like whitetails do. He kind of jumped the string on me. But instead of squatting down, he actually spun towards me, and my arrow actually stuck him right in the jugular, impacted in his spine, dropped him like a bag of rocks.
Wow.
And I'm standing there with a giant deer in headlight stare with a borrowed bow in one hand. And I look at my guide and he goes, "Danny, congratulations on your first blue wildebeest."
Man,
and you know, we shook hands and we went up there to celebrate this blue wildebeest who's, you know, laying there with my arrow sticking out of his neck. And while I'm celebrating with this blue wildebeest, our tracker starts yelling at us in Afrikaans, is the language they speak over there, because my gemsbuck jumped up from behind one of the bushes and started taking off. So we end up going after the gemsbuck, and we came up close enough to him as well. And I ended up putting another arrow in her and called it good. And let's just say I celebrated really hard that night back at the back at the campfire. And my dad, he was, I think, just as tickled pink as I was that I actually got something.
Yeah.
But after that, I put the bow down and picked up the rifle and went to the gun range. They had to kind of coach me on how to properly shoot a rifle because I've been bow hunting for so long.
Yeah.
And I went out there and I just had a blast. Just, you know, I shot everything that was on my list, to include a baboon and a warthog, one zebra, and one, what they call a greater kudu. And it was, I tell you the truth, man, I had the time of my life. It was definitely a very memorable hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a lot of things that I want to do on my end first, but I'm not counting Africa out. I think that's something that I'll do when I get a little older and after I've checked off some of more North American species, like, you know, but I think, you know, it'd be something, I think it would be awesome for me and my wife to go to Africa at some point and do
that. Would be cool. Yeah. She doesn't hunt as well though, does she?
Well, she does. She will. Okay, cool. I think now she's taking that turn, right? She's starting to get into it a little bit more. She went shotgun hunting this year with me for deer. And I think if I can talk, like, we've even, this is crazy, but we've even discussed antelope hunting as well. So trying to go out out west and maybe get her a rifle antelope, that would be awesome. Yeah. But man, I'm not gonna count Africa out yet. So that's something that I'll have to do a lot of thinking about. So just so everybody knows roughly, and what I have to look forward to, was that like a $10,000 trip for you?
It's shy of $10,000. I think altogether trophy fees, the hunt itself and taxidermist airfare, I think it maybe came out to, I want to say about $6,000 or $7,000 is what I'm estimating.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Yeah.
I got you.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't realize this, but for the price of going to Africa, is about the same price as, actually it's cheaper to go to Africa and take seven species than it is to pay for a guide to take you somewhere through Colorado or Wyoming and take one bull elk.
Yeah.
You know?
That's nuts.
Yeah.
So did you get any of those species taxidermied?
I did, yes. I couldn't pass it up. Of course, I got the wife's approval on which ones I was going to get shoulder mounts on. And she definitely said no to the warthog. And she said no to the blue and the black wildebeest. And no to the baboon.
Gotcha. But the rest. So what did you get taxidermied from that trip?
I got a shoulder mount of the greater kudu. And I got a shoulder mount done on the gemsbuck.
Okay.
The rest are just skulls and hides to, you know, hang up here and there.
Right. So do they do all the taxidermy over there and then ship you a crate?
Yes, exactly. In fact, I just found out that my ship has just arrived in country. And when I get off work Thursday morning, it looks like I can go pick it up. So
awesome. Yeah. So what's that? Excited. What's that cost to get that taxidermied?
The taxidermy total bill, I think, came, I want to say, about $3,000.
Okay.
Well, no, I'm sorry. That's $2,500, I think.
That's not as bad as I thought it would.
No, definitely not.
Huh. Well, and that's on top of the $6,000. That you already told me, right?
No, that's basically the $6,000 total, include taxidermist, hunting, all that stuff. I'm just estimating about $6,000 with all that stuff.
Gotcha.
Maybe $7,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not bad. Well, I tell you
what. If my wife's listening, we're going to go with $6,000.
Amen. Amen. Well, I tell you what, Danny, man, I really appreciate, first off, thanks for your service. Second,
thank you. I appreciate the support.
Yeah. And second, thanks for taking time to hop on the podcast today, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. I like doing this stuff and talking about hunting stories and whatnot. It's a good time.
Well, good luck on all your other adventures that come your way. And maybe we'll talk again.
Yeah, sounds good, man. Good luck to you as well.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another podcast in the books. Huge shout out to Danny for hopping on and chatting with us today, man. Loved that BS session. Huge shout out to all of you again. Thank you for taking time out of your day to download, to listen. Please go wherever you download the podcast, leave a review, right? Thank you very much for that. Huge shout out to all the partners of this podcast. That is Exodus, Ozonix, Wasp, Lone Wolf, Deer Lab, Prime, Ripcord, and Hunter Safety Systems. Follow us along on social, right? Instagram and Facebook. Not only the Nine Finger Chronicles, but the Sportsman's Nation as well. You know, keep an eye out for that. Lots of content coming through this channel. So please, if you haven't already, go and visit sportsmensnation.com, and that's M-E-N-S, sportsmensnation.com. If you haven't visited the website, man, we don't just have podcasts. We have written articles, and we also have videos there as well. My man Parker from Southern Ground is putting out some kick-ass vlogs, so keep an eye out for that. You know, and like I said at the beginning of the podcast, man, just go spend some time with your family. It's very important. If there's someone you're holding a grudge against within your family, it's not worth it, right? If it's just not worth it. So call them up, talk to them, get everything out on the open, talk about it, put it behind you, because we all die at some point. And it's not worth going to the grave with a grudge, or going to, I don't know. So hopefully everybody has a great rest of the week. Hopefully we have a positive week, right? And our friends at Hunter Safety Systems are reminding us, if you're gonna be in a tree, wear your damn safety harness.